Isaiah chapter 8. Last week we covered the part of the story where, you know, Uzziah, the king, had died. His son Jotham took his place, but then his son Ahaz is where we picked up the story in chapter 7. Ahaz, we took note as we read through the account of Ahaz. He was a wicked king. He did really awful things. And yet God, because of his promise to Judah, because of his word, and because for his name's sake, he was willing to spare Judah. And of course, he gave that word to Ahaz through Isaiah the prophet. And Ahaz didn't want to hear it. He didn't want to listen to that. He didn't want to hear the warning. And so he decided to reject what God had offered him. God said, you can ask for any sign that you want, and I'll give it to you. And Ahaz said, no, I wouldn't tempt God, you know, acting like he's really spiritual. And of course, then Isaiah speaks, and God gave him a sign, remember. And the sign was the same sign we all get. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son, and they will shall call his name Emmanuel. And that was the sign that he was given, like it or not. And by the way, when people in this world, you know, look for any kind of a sign of any kind, the only one that matters is Emmanuel, God with us. It's the same sign. And by the way, whether they like it or not, that's the only sign that there is that really means anything. And Ahaz didn't want it. He didn't want the sign, but he got it anyway. You know, God said, well, I'll give you a sign anyway. This is the sign. My son's coming. You better get ready. So we saw then that, you know, Ahaz then was told what would happen because of his rejection of the warning that God had given and his offer, God's offer to kind of redeem them out of that situation. But because of their rejection and their continued rebellion, then God said, well, then it's coming. Judgment's coming. Now, the prediction of what takes place is still continuing on now in chapter 8. It's really the specific prediction, prophecy concerning the Assyrians that came down and swept through. Now, remember, we talked about last week that Ahaz, he made a kind of a pact with the Assyrian king, remember, to protect himself from the northern tribes of Israel and Syria who had joined forces. And he thought, Ahaz thought that he was making a pretty good move by joining forces with the Assyrian king. I mean, now if you look on a map of ancient Assyria, you'll see the Assyrian Empire is gigantic. It was huge. And if you look on a map, you'll see that it encompasses much of what we know now as the whole Middle East. The Assyrians were huge. And they made Syria and the 10 tribes of Israel look mighty puny in comparison in size. Now, making a deal with the Assyrian king might seem like a wise move from a worldly standpoint because you think you're getting some big guy with a big empire on your side. But you've got to be careful when you do that because the big guy is a big guy for a reason. Now, he's glad to help you out in taking over the 10 tribes of Israel, wiping them out or taking them captive as they did, and Syria along with them. Sure, why not? But Judah, you better watch out because you're next on his list. He gave them one privilege, and that was to be swept away third, last. That was the only privilege really the Assyrians gave to Judah for making a deal with him. Now watch, this is interesting. So here now, Isaiah is going to tell him of this onslaught that's about ready to happen. Watch what he says. Moreover, now, of course, again, chapter 7, we realize that he's warned them already about making this pact with the king of Assyria. He's already warned them about that. So he says, moreover, the Lord said unto me, take thee a great roll, this is Isaiah speaking, and write in it with a man's pen concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Now, who's that? And what is that? That is going to be Isaiah's second son. And here, the Lord says, I want you to write down this boy's name. Well, he's not even conceived yet. But his name means, of course, hurry to the spoil. That's the boy's name. Remember, his other son was named what? The remnant shall return, right? That's his other son's name. He named his sons for prophetic things that were going to happen because God gave him these instructions. So he says now, I took verse 2 unto me faithful witnesses to record. That would be Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Berechiah. Take these two witnesses. In the presence of two or three witnesses, everything shall be established, the Bible said. So Isaiah took two witnesses and he wrote down this boy's name. That is, hurry to the spoil. That's the boy's name. And then he says, I went unto the prophetess. That would be Mrs. Isaiah. Isaiah was a prophet. Mrs. Isaiah was a prophetess. So he went to her and she conceived and bare a son. Then said the Lord to me, call his name Mahar Shalal Hashbaz. So Isaiah named his son exactly what the Lord had instructed him. And then the Lord said further, verse 4, for before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. So before this baby who is to be born, before this baby's even old enough to say mama and dada, the Syrians and Damascus included, and all of Samaria, which is the northern tribes, basically, all those groups of people, the northern tribes and Syria, all that, they're going to be gone within 1 to 2 years before the baby can even talk. So the Lord spake also unto me again, saying, for as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloah, that go softly and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son, meaning these people have rejected the waters of Shiloah. Now, Shiloah is a term that has reference to really more likely Shiloh and Siloam. It's a combination of the two, if you would. And it's an interesting combo. Shiloah means really Siloam or Shiloh, very similar word, but two distinct meanings. Shiloh means rest. Siloam means scent. Siloam is the pool, remember, of water that was there at the foot of Mount Zion, which is David's city of David. And then the little valley in between going up to Mount Moriah then would be where the temple was. That little teeny valley that ran in between is where the pool of Siloam was. A little trickle of water, not much to it. We go there, when we go to Israel, we kind of sit at the mouth of the pool of Siloam. You can kind of see it. It's not much to look at this point. But it was clean, pure water. And what God said to the people was, because this people refused the waters of the rest that was sent, Siloam, Shiloh, Shiloah, because you have not received the rest that I sent in those still, smooth, gentle waters, if you would, of Siloam, but rather you've rejoiced in Rezin and Remaliah's son, that is the king of Syria and the northern tribes leader, Remaliah's son. You've rejoiced in the fact that they got defeated, which they did. Judah was like, hey, we beat them. With Assyria's help. Assyria really did it. Now, because that's true, now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river. What river? Well, more than likely, the river Euphrates. Why do I say that? Because Assyria was centered there. Nineveh was in Assyria. And the Euphrates River, if you look on again on a map, you'll see where the Euphrates River just runs right up through there, and the Euphrates was huge. It's a huge river, and the Assyrians used that as their main water source. So no doubt he's speaking of the Assyrians' water, which is the Euphrates River. He says, so because you rejected the waters of Shiloah, the restful peace and so forth that I sent, therefore the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria. And all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. Meaning, Assyria is going to overflow into Judah with power, with like a mighty river. So God's picture there is, I had still waters. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, right? He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me before the still water, right? Restful, peaceful is what the Lord wants for me. But if I refuse that, if a person refuses that, I'm going to make a deal with the king of Assyria. We're going to buddy up, right? This is what the northern tribes did. Well, they got wiped out. And now, you see, as far as the northern tribes and Assyria, that's already finished. And Judah now is rejoicing because we had a smart plan. We had already made a deal with Assyria. And they took them out. And now, look, we're good to go. Oh, boy. You're good to go, all right. The Assyrians got you in their sights now, Judah. And that's going to be the problem. And God says, well, they're going to overflow their banks all over you. And he shall pass through Judah, and he shall overflow and go over, and he shall reach even to the neck. Now, this is interesting. Isaiah says, he's coming, and he is coming with power. Again, just check out an ancient map of the Assyrian Empire. Compare to little Judah down there in the southern part of Israel. This little dot is Israel. This huge mass of land is the Assyrian Empire. They were huge. And they could have, by all accounts, humanly speaking, could have wiped out Judah just like that. But note what is said through the prophet. They'll come to the very neck. Now, when you're in hot water, if you're in a river that's raging, like is warned here, and you're up to your neck, you're in trouble, but you're not sunk, huh? You're still out of the water. Your head's out of the water. You're up to your neck, and that's dangerous, but you're not dead, correct? So it'll come to the very neck, this raging river of power from Assyria. And the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. Whoa, wait a minute. What's Emmanuel? God with us. So God warns the people that Assyria is coming down. They're going to break that pact that they have with Ahaz. They're not going to listen to Ahaz. Ahaz was a puppet for them. So now they're going to come down. But God says, you're going to be in trouble, but only to the neck. They'll never take Jerusalem. And they didn't. This is interesting. They didn't take Jerusalem. They'll take and get right to the very neck. And then they won't make it. Do you know why? Because this is Emmanuel's land. And he's never going to let it be completely destroyed. He never had before, and he never will here, and he never will ever, will he? If it's his, if it's God with us, if that's his land, then he's going to protect it. Oh, they're going to get some pretty severe damage brought upon them for their rebellion and rejection. But again, there's always a remnant. There's always that small group that's going to make it. It's God's land. Now watch. So he says to them, now watch this. Associate yourselves, O ye people, and you shall be broken in pieces. Warning Judah not to associate with these people, not to make pacts with people like this. This is just a good warning for us, I think. A lot of times people will try to kind of negotiate, in a sense, with the world, kind of compromise their stance on things, try to kind of maneuver things so that they can get ahead, or they make some decision based upon that, and they try to maneuver things so that they can, you know, and they call it being intelligent and smart, but God has a different word for it, you know. And he says, if you associate yourselves in this way, O ye people, you shall be broken in pieces. You'll be broken. This is not going to be a productive union. And give ear. Now he warns them, who? The Assyrians. And you shall be broken in pieces, he says, and give ear, all you of a far country. All you, and that would be Assyria, all you that come against Judah, you need to be warned. Now he's warned Judah, those are his people. And then he says to the far countries, gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. In other words, you can try and gird up against this, but I'm going to break you. God would not sit by and let the Assyrians, the Babylonians, or anybody else do to his people. Even though he used them to discipline his people, he would not allow them to get away with it. He still won't. The end of the age that we're living in presently will end with what's called the Great Tribulation. And it's judgment. It's judgment. Everything that's been done against God or God's people will be judged, just like he's warning here. Gird yourselves up if you want to, he says, but you're going to be broken in pieces. He says it again. He says, gird yourselves and you shall be broken in pieces. Go ahead, gird yourself up. Get yourself as strong as you think you can be, and then we'll see what happens. These are stern words for the Assyrians who have all this might and power, you know. And, you know, the children of Judah, the children of Israel, the tribe of Judah, they knew better than to make alliances with evil, didn't they? You say, well, were the Assyrians really evil? Assyrians were one of the most brutal people in Israel's history. The Assyrians were really, really brutal. They just did stuff to people. You know, part of their conquest was humiliation. And, you know, they were known to skewer people from the groin up through the head and just leave them, you know, kind of skewered there outside of their cities to warn everybody not to mess with the Assyrians. They were just a bad bunch and big, you know. They were barbaric and they were huge. And, it's, you know, it's not a whole lot different than what we know as the world today. All that stuff, you know, may not go on in the physical sense, but people are being skewered all over the place in our society in one way or the other. So he says, go ahead, gird yourself up. It won't help. He says, take counsel together and it shall come to naught. So you can go ahead, you can plot and plan, you can join forces with as many people on this planet as you want, he tells them, but it will come to nothing. Just like in the end days of this age we live in, the world, as you know, is going to actually try to come against God. At the end of the Battle of Armageddon, when Jesus returns, the forces of this world that are opposing God will actually try to turn and fight against him. I mean, the glory in which Jesus returns with is incredible, magnificent. And yet, they're going to say, get him! Like, boy, are you dumb. I mean, what a dumb thing to try and do, right? The creator of the universe, who spins the universe at 430,000 miles per hour. He spins it like this. I'm going to take him on? And you're in that universe somewhere, a little speck in there. And he's spinning the whole thing. And men are going to say, we'll take you on, you know. Boy, go ahead, he says. Counsel together. Take counsel. Ooh, I'm scared, you know. Speak the word, he says, and it shall not stand. Why? For God is with us. Now, this is Isaiah speaking, of course. And so he's prophetically warning Judah and then prophetically warning Assyria for what they're going to do. Even though God's going to allow it, he's only going to allow it to go so far. He'll never allow the annihilation of his people. He never has. He never will. People always say, you know, and you know how this works, folks. You've heard it. You know the schemes and the plots of Islam. They want to eliminate the Jews from off the face of the earth. And the Christians, if they could do that as well. The Jews are a little easier target for them, so that's why they want them first. They have a particular hatred for the Jews because of the rejection that the Jews showed to Muhammad, right? Muhammad was filled with this kind of rage against the Jews because he tried to get the Jews to join him in his kind of lunacy, if you would, of you know, Allah and all this. And the Jews said, okay, you're crazy. Right, we don't want anything to do with it. And so he had this particular rage against them, and it still goes on to this day. But you know, their plot to eliminate the Jews is never going to take place. They can plot and scheme, like God says here to the Assyrians. You can speak about it if you want to, but it's not going to stand. Why? Because God is with them, right? That's why. It's still his land. It's still his people. You know, it's not going to happen. Then it was not going to happen in the future. It's just not going to take place. For the Lord spake thus to me, Isaiah says, with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people. So Isaiah now kind of pipes up and says, look, God spoke to me with a strong hand, meaning pretty sternly. And he warns Isaiah personally, don't you walk in the way of these people. You know, well, why would he have to say that to Isaiah? He was a prophet. Yeah, prophets, you know, are men. You know, and God had to deal. Remember chapter 6 of Isaiah? Remember his own personal testimony? The year King Uzziah died, he says, I saw the Lord, and you know, in the temple, and that, whoa, man, you know, he was undone. Remember, he realized he was a man of unclean lips and all those things. Remember, Isaiah had to deal with the same things you and I deal with. And so God had to speak to him, and sometimes sternly, about not following after this way of life, you know. for Isaiah, for us, for anybody who says they belong to God and want to follow God, the same warning applies. Stay away from that worldly lifestyle. Don't walk in the way of this people, he says, saying, and again, he says, don't walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy, neither fear ye fear, nor be afraid. So he says, don't say, hey, it's the potency of a confederacy that matters, you know, to all them, to this people who say a confederacy is really important. In other words, don't get the idea, God says, that you're going to join something in this world that's really going to amount to much. This is just key. We live in a day and an age where people want to belong to something. You know, political parties or whatever. You know, they want to be on the right or the left, or they want to be in the middle, or they want to be on top, or they're below. Or I mean, they want to belong somewhere, right? But God said that's not the key. Belonging to some confederacy, some joint union between some power play that you're making. That's not the key. And all them that would say that, right? Isaiah warned them that that's not the important thing. He says, neither fear ye their fear. In other words, don't get hung up, Isaiah, on what they fear, because they fear what men can do to them. They fear what men can do. He says, so don't be afraid like they're afraid. So all these things God spoke to Isaiah, don't walk like they walk. Don't get involved with confederacies and putting, you know, a bunch of emphasis in your life on that. Don't fear what they fear. Just don't do it. The world's afraid of a lot of things. We're not supposed to be afraid of the world and the things of this world. He says, now here's what you do though. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself. That is, set apart. Sanctify means to set apart. Set apart the Lord of hosts himself, meaning everything that they're involved with, confederacies, the things they fear, you know, walking the way they walk, all the things that they're involved with, don't get involved with that. But here's what you do, Isaiah. You sanctify the Lord, meaning you set him apart as everything for you. That's the idea. You set him apart to be your all in all. That's the only real thing that matters, is where does God in my life? That's the real issue. And he says, sanctify the Lord himself and let him be your fear and let him be your dread. If you want to fear something, fear God. And it's been wisely said, if you do fear God, then you don't need to fear anything else. If your real respect is towards God, and you fear him in a godly way. In other words, hey, I respect God enough to know he is spinning this universe, right? And he can spin it any way he wants. And we're subject unto the span. So he can do whatever. So I have a good deal of respect for God. You know what I mean? He's the one with all the power. He's the one with all the grace. He's the one with all the mercy. He's the one with all the peace. He's the one with all the joy. Shall I keep going? He's the one that's got all the things that my heart is longing for deep down. So I respect him because I want to be around him. I want to be near him. I want the things that he has to offer. And so if I want those things and I respect him, I don't respect anything else, anybody else to that same degree or even close. So he says now, if I do that, setting him apart, sanctifying the Lord, and I respect, fear him, then it says, and he shall be for a sanctuary. In other words, if I set him apart, then he will be for me a sanctuary. But note what happens first. I set him apart. I set God in a place where he is apart from everything and everyone else. There's no one like him. There's nothing in this world like him. And I set him apart in that way. When I do so, and I don't let anything even in the neighborhood, Jesus said, you know, if you want to follow me, it's going to be like you hate everyone else. You know, he didn't mean you hate people. He told us to love people. But he said, in comparison to loving me, it'll seem like hatred towards other people. That's the difference. In other words, sanctifying him, separating him apart from everything else, then he shall be a sanctuary for me. So when people say, well, I'm not sure God's really a sanctuary for me, I'm not sure then that he's really all that for me in that way. Well, then my response is going to be, then you haven't made him, you haven't set him apart to be all that for you. You see, I have something to do with this. And we talked about the fact that, you know, the vineyard parable that Isaiah told, that God shared with him, remember? And Israel and Judah in particular was the vineyard, remember? And that vineyard, you know, represents, you know, so much for all of us, you know. And they were just not willing to put their lives in order in such a way that they would produce fruit for him. They produced sour grapes or bad fruit, remember? The reason was is because they did not set him apart for that. They didn't honor him. When I don't produce fruit that's good in my life, there's only one reason. I haven't honored God. That's it. Well, I don't like to think of it that way. I like to think of it, I just kind of blew it a little bit, you know, or I just kind of made some bad choices. I made some mistakes, that's for sure. No. Let's get down to business with that one. We just didn't honor God, and we bore bad fruit as a result. That's the reality. It sounds worse, doesn't it? I mean, we like the other way better because it just sounds a little better. No, I blew it. That sounds better than, no, I just didn't honor God in that. But setting him apart is how he becomes my sanctuary. I set him apart, and that's what he is. Remember, we talked about it. The vineyard, because they would not make him everything for them, then he became nothing to them. This is key. They wouldn't make him their God. So he wasn't, in a sense. When I don't make him my God, and I always love the picture of Jesus when he rode into Jerusalem, and it says that the disciples set him on that donkey. The donkey was the animal that a king rode in times of peace. So they basically set Jesus on him and made him king. We have to make him our king. Oh, he's the King of Kings. He's the King of Glory. There's no doubt about it. But I need to set him there. I need to sanctify him. People say, he's not my sanctuary. He's not. Well, then he's not been set apart by you. You got other things in the way. Set him apart and he will be that sanctuary. But it'll be like a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for Judah and Israel. Doesn't matter. Now we're talking northern, southern tribes. Let's get rid of that confederacy thing. Let's deal with the issue here. The hearts of the people were doing this kind of unhonorable thing to God, both northern and southern tribes. And God didn't just love Judah. He loved all of Israel. But here, he's going to become not a sanctuary to them. Why? Because they didn't make him one. What did they make him? They made him a rock of offense. They made him a stumbling for themselves. Jesus said it, didn't he? He says, look, this rock, he says, you know, you can either, you know, fall upon this rock and you'll be broken. But if this rock falls on you, you'll be crushed to powder. Meaning, everybody has an encounter with the rock, Jesus Christ. Better to fall on him and be broken. Broken over your sin, broken over the condition of your life. Better to fall on Jesus Christ and be broken than to have him fall on you in judgment, which will crush you. But they made him this. And don't get this wrong. Everybody who's ever lived on this earth, who ever faces judgment and faces God, and they all will, when that time comes, every single person will know without question they made God an offense. They made him a stumbling stone. They didn't fall on him and be broken. They forced his hand to fall on them and crush them. That's the deal. And that's what's being said here. The people of Israel, Judah included, they were dealing with a heart issue of making God a stumbling, a snare for their life. And this is the way it is. When people come to me and say, oh, I don't know, God's, I don't know, is he mean? Is he cruel? I mean, I'm just not having any fun in life. And I'm thinking, you know, you're trapped. You're in a snare. You're ensnared by what you've made God out to be. You know, here in a puny little mind like ours, we try to make God, you know, into this thing that he's not, and we get ensnared by it. And there's a lot of people ensnared by what their perception of what God is. rather than letting God determine and say who he is and saying, that's right, I agree. You are God, spinning the universe. You're big. You've got the power. You are incredible. Me, not incredible, right? I am nothing. You are everything. That's the proper position. But when I make him less than he is in my sight, I make him a stumbling and I'm ensnared by my own perception of God. What is our perception of God? That's really what it boils down to. Everybody has to deal with that question. Who is God to me? Is he set apart? Because if he is, he can be my sanctuary. He can be my rest, my peace, my joy. Right? So who he is to me is who I've made him to be. Oh, God wouldn't deal with me on that level, would he? Oh, yeah. Because he won't force our hand. He's warning them that they are in the very midst of turning themselves into a people that are going to be ensnared and trapped because their perception's wrong. They are thinking wrong about God, and they're acting that out. And God says, well, that's going to cause you some problems. And he says, verse 15, many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. Okay, there's the deal. Hear me on this, folks. It's no different for us than it was for these people back then. God invites us, doesn't he, to just embrace everything that he says. Be a part of him. Be filled with his spirit, right? Walk in his ways. Enjoy peace and just immense joy and all these things. He invites us to do that. But he will also allow us then, if we're going to make him something else in our life, then he will say, like he did to them, well, that could cause you to stumble and fall, be broken and be snared and be taken. Taken where? Captive. Don't get this wrong. Whenever people are taken captive, ensnared, stumbling, falling, all these terms we like to use because they sound like we didn't have any control, doesn't it? I stumbled, tripped, fell, you know, all these things. I just, you know, it just happened to me. I didn't have anything to do with it, right? All these things, God says, well, okay, all those things are going to happen, but you need to know why they're happening. You've made God something less in your thinking and in your heart than he is. So when I fall or stumble or trip or whatever, you know, slip, ooh, you know, all those things that I don't want to take any responsibility for because actually they happened to me. I didn't do anything with them. If that's where I'm at, I need to understand that is only because I've made God something else in my life. Because if he is set apart as God Almighty, right, then he will be my sanctuary. He will be my power. He will be my strength. He will be my peace. He will be my joy. When those things are missing, it's because I have made God something else. Well, you're not saying God will be what we make him to be. No, he'll be God, period. You just won't experience him as God in those ways because you do have something to say about how powerfully God works in your life, don't you? God says, doesn't he, over and over, trust me and what? You'll experience peace, right? Don't trust me? Boy, that's going to be a fearful event, right? He's telling them over and over again, set me apart, I'll be your sanctuary. Don't set me apart, I guess there's no sanctuary for you. Do you ever feel sometimes like you don't have a sanctuary? It's kind of a spooky deal, isn't it? You don't feel like you have any safe haven, safe place. Well, that's because there's some distance between you and God. And guess who moved? Guess who created that distance? That's all he's saying here. Is it's a stumbling because you've made it such. I've made it that way. And many are going to do this. They're going to fall. They're going to be broken and taken captive. Nobody just kind of, you know, all of a sudden finds himself in some severe bondage to drugs or alcohol or pornography or whatever it might be. Nobody just all of a sudden, hey, I don't know what happened. I'm just in bondage. All of a sudden, I've just been taken away into this thing. I don't know what happened. The Assyrians swept down, right? Well, who joined to the Assyrians? When you're taken captive by something, you join to it. We join to it. That's why it took us captive. Oh, I don't like this study. I'm not liking this one. This is not what I wanted to hear tonight. Well, see, here's the deal. God is so pointed about this. He says, look, you fell. You fell. You were broken. You got taken. But don't think that you didn't bring this on by joining yourself to the Assyrians, because you did. And it's the same thing for, do you see it? It's just so amazing how God, you know, just speaks the truth like this. So he says now, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. He tells Isaiah, now listen, you need to bind up the testimony. In other words, shore up your own testimony, Isaiah. And for any of us Isaiahs tonight, shore up, bind up your own testimony. Take a look at your own testimony and seal that law of the word of God among the disciples. In other words, if we're going to be the disciples of God, let's not be those that say, oh yeah, I'm falling, slipping, doing, you know, all those things, taken away captive, and I don't know what happened. Although, don't even go there. Bind up your own testimony by setting God apart. And I will wait upon the Lord, he says, that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. This is what Isaiah says. You know what? I am going to bind up my own testimony. I want to shore up my own walk. And this is what I'm going to do. He says, I will wait upon the Lord. What does that mean? That means I'm going to wait for him. Waiting on the Lord is one of the worst things known to man, I think, for any of us. Lord, would you just do this or do that? And whenever you get this message from God, you know it. It's not yes. It's not no. It's wait. Right? It's like, give me anything to do but wait, right? Because you don't even know what you're waiting for sometimes. When God just puts that in your spirit, just wait on me. What's that mean? I'm busy, right? I'm busy. How am I supposed to wait around, right? That's the idea. But Isaiah says, here's the key. You wait on him after you have sanctified him. Can't wait on the Lord unless he's sanctified. If you don't set him apart, you're not going to wait on him. You won't bother. Ooh, this is tough, right? You mean when I'm not willing to wait on the Lord, I haven't sanctified him, I haven't set him apart? Exactly. Which is why probably you're stumbling and bumbling, tripping and falling and being taken. That's the idea. So he says, well, I will wait upon the Lord, Isaiah says, that hides his face from the house of Jacob. Well, presently he was, wasn't he? God was like, I'm not showing my face right now. I'm letting you play this out. Sometimes God does that. I'll just let you play it out since you're persisting in it. But he says, no, I'm gonna wait upon the Lord who's hiding his face from Jacob right now, and I will look for him. Isaiah says, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to wait on him, and I'm going after him. I'm going to look for where he's at. Well, where would he be? Where is God? Where do you find him today? You go, you know, looking under rocks and in the woods or on the golf course. Where are you looking for God? Right? Right here. In the word. In prayer. In worship. In quiet times, waiting upon him. If you want to see him, if you want to know him better, then go look for him, and you know where to find him. We all know where to find him. People say, oh, I'm just really trying to get close to God. Well, what's stopping you, right? All these pious things that Christians say cracks me up. Like, oh, I'm really seeking the Lord. Really? Isaiah said, I'm just going to go look for him. I'm going to look for him. So if you're seeking him, then, you know, go looking for him. He's right there. He's in the word. He's in the times of prayer and worship and fellowshipping. Even you might even hear from the Lord through a brother or sister, you know, if you don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. So all these things, you see, God says, hey, Isaiah, you need to be shoring up your own witness and testimony. He says, that's true. So he says, I'm going to go look for him. And then he says, behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and for wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Remember what he named his two sons now, right? Me and my kids. Isaiah means God is salvation. That's his name. That was a sign, right, to the people. His one son meant, his name meant a remnant shall return. His other son, hey, hurry up to the spoil. There's all those things woven into their very names. His kids and him were a testimony just by their name. By the way, we all have associated with us, doesn't matter really what your physical name is, we all bear a name with us. We all kind of preach who we are, don't we? Isaiah said, you know what? Me and my children, we're signs and wonders for this people. And so are we. We are signs and wonders for these people that are out there, that are taken captive, that are in bondage, that are rebelling, that are running amok. You and me are signs and wonders for these people. What you encompass in your life, what you say, what you do, the way you say it, the way you do it, the things that we are involved with, the things we aren't involved with, things that we are constantly doing and saying and being, we are signs and wonders for these people that are around us. For Isaiah, it was Israel. For us, it's the world at large that we're living in. Now, verse 19. When they shall say unto you, seek unto them that have familiar spirits. This is what Isaiah was going to hear. When they say this unto you, Isaiah, God's warning Isaiah, these people are going to come back at you with some weird stuff. You ever encountered that? You're shoring up your testimony. You're binding up your own witness, you know, hey, and then you just talk with somebody. Hey, let me share this. And they come back with some really weird things. Does that ever happen? Yeah. Well, listen to what God warns Isaiah. He says, when they shall say to you, hey, let's seek unto them that have familiar spirits. In other words, demons. Let's inquire the demons and ask them what we should do. Well, that's a good idea, right? Why didn't I think of that? Let's ask demons what to do. Certainly, they'll steer us in the right direction. Does this sound stupid to you? It is, but is this what it goes on? Yeah. Do you think that the psychic hotline doesn't make any money? They got a 1-800 number for a reason, because people call it. They call it. Hey, tell me my future, or tell me, you know, I'm doing this or I'm doing that. Tell me how that's going to work out. Okay, you know, here's this minimum wage yo-yo on the phone, right? Telling this person, as they're paying them money, telling them what to do and how it's going to work out. They don't have a clue. They're just making it up, right? I always want to call one of those, say, hey, why don't you play the stock market and retire and quit working for minimum wage if you're a prophet, you know, if you're psychic or whatever. Doesn't that make more sense? Of course, they never thought of that. What kind of psychic are they? I mean, the idea is that people call these people up. Why? Because they'd rather seek out a familiar spirit than ask God for direction. And when they say to you, Isaiah, let's go find some demons to ask, right? As this warning, and unto wizards that peep, by the way, and that mutter. Okay, so now this isn't making any sense at all. Let's do this. Let's go see demons and ask them what we're supposed to do. And then let's go talk to wizards who peep and mutter. What is that even? What is even peeping and muttering about? Well, it simply means saying absolutely nothing. So let's ask demons what to do and then ask wizards who say absolutely nothing. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? God says, should not a people seek unto their God for the living to the dead? In other words, why wouldn't you go to the living God instead of these dead, demonic, putrid, perverted spirits that are not going to live, no life in them? They're like the walking dead. Why would you go talk to them? It's like talking to a dead man. Why would you do that? Right? God just puts it straight. Why wouldn't you seek me? Talk to me. To the law and to the testimony. If they speak not according to this word, he tells Isaiah, it is because there is no light in them. Let me just say it plain and simple. If people, whoever it might be, I don't care who they are, I don't care how much credibility the world gives them, if they do not speak this word, there is no light in them. That's it. That's all there is to it. If the word of God is not spoken by them, and this truth is not rolling off their lips, then they have no light. That's plain and simple. And that include the law and the testimony. The law, speaking of the word, and the testimony that's associated with the word. If that's not happening, then there's no light. And you stay away, because that's only darkness that they encompass. Now, he says, and they shall pass through it, hardly bestead and hungry. Meaning, they're going to go through this. People that seek that kind of stuff, they're going to go through the process of life hungry, starving really, without nourishment, without sustaining power in their life. They go through life hungry, and it shall come to pass that when they shall be hungry, they shall fret themselves and curse their king and their God and look upward. Meaning, they curse everything because nothing works out. This reminds me of when the book of Revelation declares about the judgment of God being poured out on this earth during the Battle of Armageddon at the end, and even before that, during the Great Tribulation. The worse things get on this earth, the more men curse God. They shake their fist at God. It's your fault. When it's their fault, you know. But they're going to go through life hungry, meaning there's no satiation of the soul. There's nothing for their soul. They're totally empty and starving inside. They'll curse the king, they'll curse God, they'll there curse anything and everyone. I mean, it's everybody else's fault. Right? It's the ultimate dysfunctional person. You know, everything that's happened to me is somebody else's fault. I take absolutely zero responsibility for anything I've ever done. Somebody else did it to me or for me or whatever. I had nothing to do with it. I'm a victim of everything and everyone. It's the self-pitying, absolute degradation of the sinful soul who doesn't want to be broken over their sin. That's what happens to them. God says, boy, there's going to be a number of them like this. And they shall look unto the earth. Note that. And behold, trouble and darkness. They're going to look to the earth. They'll look upward to curse God, but then they'll look to the earth, to the world, to see if they can find some help. But what will they find? Behold, trouble and darkness, dimness of anguish, and they shall be driven to darkness. Here's the detrimental process for people, whether it's them back then, whether it's people today. When people disregard what God has said in his word, back then he was telling them, giving them the warning, telling them the truth. But they disregarded it. And when they continued to do that over and over again, they begin now to blame God, blame the king, blame whoever. It's everybody else's fault and I curse them all. And then they begin now to move into the earth or the world, if you would, for their help. Oh, they're seeking out demons. They're seeking out familiar spirits, wizards that peep and mutter and all that. They're looking for anything and everything that will try to, you know, be of assistance to them, but they can find nothing because there's nothing there. How can you get help from nothing? God is true and living, but they've rejected him. So what happens is that they then look to the earth and behold, all they find is trouble and darkness and dimness of anguish. Everything that they go after leaves their soul in anguish to the point that they then are driven even deeper into darkness. Wow. See, by the time a soul will reach hell one day, it has driven itself into the darkness, that outer darkness. They drive themselves there. This process, guys, doesn't happen just like that. It's a determination that's made again and again and again and again. There's not one person that will ever wind up one day in hell that can say, you know, I don't belong here. I mean, I spent my entire life seeking God. No. Because all of the facades, all the games will be stripped. When the person gets that moment in time with God, and they will, every person. People say, well, we'll just see about that. When I get there and I'll have a few things to say to God. Yeah. You ever hear somebody say that? And you're like, buddy, you aren't going to say a thing. When you get before God, you are going to be prostrate on your face, on the ground, shaking, and all you're going to be able to acknowledge is, you are the Lord. You're the Lord. And when he looks upon that person, every single game and every single phony baloney thing they tried to pull off will be stripped, and they'll know exactly what they've done. There's not going to be any guesswork with it. It's not going to be like, You know, God's not going to weigh out things like they think he's going to, well, they'll look at the good and bad I've done. I don't think you want him to do that. You know, people are so arrogant. They think, yeah, I've done pretty good things in my life. Yeah, should we look at the bad? Because, you know, it's kind of an unbalanced scale. You know, here's your good, and then here's the bad. You know, it's just like, that's it. We're done. You know what I mean? But when they get there, when they get to that point, this is why. It's the same process. And man, it's staggering to me. I look at it and I go, ooh, wow. But honestly, if I'm just the least bit honest with myself, I know that my salvation is secure. I mean, I know I'm going to heaven. I'm not worried about that. But I know that in a nutshell, this kind of involves me in the sense that I can experience this kind of foolishness in my own life if I'm not careful. Again, it comes from not sanctifying God, setting him apart. And then I find myself not experiencing him as my sanctuary. And I'm starting to kind of do goofy things, right? Finding myself stumbling, falling, all those things. You know, just pretty soon I'm taken away with something. I'm like, what? Where? You know what I mean? And then what? Well, you're going to stop and go, I got to wait on the Lord. I've got to seek him. I need to make him set apart in my life, and then he'll be my sanctuary again. That's a process I've gone through more times than I'm willing to admit to you. God knows, and you don't have to tell me. But we all know, don't we? That seems to be a process that we live with again and again and again. My hope is, of course, being set apart in that sense, God for me and my sanctuary, he says that we are set apart for him. There's the good news. He sets you apart, and so you are his. And that's good news, because no one could take you out of the Father's hand, Jesus said. What if I stumbled and fall? Well, that's not a matter of if you do that. It's a matter of when you do it and how often you do it. But that doesn't take you out of the Father's hand. You know that. And again, I just want to remind you of what Paul says there in Romans 8, that he, the Father, who planned this whole thing, knew you before. He foreknew you before he created anything, didn't he? Therefore, Paul says, he predestined you, didn't he? Then what? Well, then he called you. And then what? And then he justified you. And then what? And now he's sanctifying you. And then what? Well, then he glorifies you, right? That whole process takes place. Now, here's the key that you need to understand, because I know you're sitting there going, boy, I've done some pretty dumb things, and am I safe? Yeah, if you are his, you're his. And here's why. If he foreknew you, right, and he is going to glorify you, and that's his plan, and that's his declaration, then what makes me think somewhere in the middle here, I'm going to mess it up? Do you know what I'm saying? If he foreknew me and he is going to glorify me, then he has predestined me, he has called me, right? He has justified me and is sanctifying me and will glorify me. Well, what if I mess up? Again, that's not an if. That's not an if. That is a when that happens. Do what Isaiah was instructed to do. Isaiah, you need to wait on me. Seek me. Don't do what they're doing. Don't go off doing what they're doing. Don't live like the world's living. You seek me. You come and wait upon me. Make me your sanctuary again. Make me your God again in that sense. In every aspect of your life. And I will be. I will be your sanctuary. I will be your strength and peace and joy and all those things. But he's going to take us from foreknowing us all the way to glory. Do you understand that? And we are just, I'm telling you, people are just arrogant enough to think and assume that somehow they, in their awesome power, are going to mess that plan up for God. You know what I mean? Not going to happen. Not going to happen. That's why Jesus said, Father, all those that you have given me, I have kept, and not one of them is lost. Notice who keeps us. He keeps us. Peter says it. We are kept by the power of God, not by yourself, not by your own doing, not by your undoing. That's the good news. Isn't it? Oh yeah, I sanctify him. I sanctify you, Lord. But the better news is he sanctifies you. You are set apart for him. That means for eternity, you belong to God. Whew. Thank you. That was worth the price of admission right there. Right? Like, whoo-wee. Going to heaven. Huh. Now that ought to, in us, really stir us to just seek him and live for him and get away from the goofy stuff that the world is trying to make you get caught up in, right? What a bill of goods they're trying to serve up. You know what? Like, here, get involved with that. Here, do that. It's almost like the thing that Isaiah is saying here. It's like, oh, hey, let's go seek some demons and ask them what to do. It's like, I mean, you hear that, right? And you go, brother, right? What a dumb thing to even suggest. And yet, that's what our world suggests, you know? Seek out these weird things, go after that, do this, go to that seminar, they'll tell you how to do it, right? It's like, what? And people do it. Why? They're being driven into darkness. That's what they're doing. And that's why we pray for people that are in that kind of worldly mode, don't we? Pray for them. Oh, Lord, we want them saved. So gird up, bind up your testimony, your own walk. Shore it up, get it tight, get it strong, and live it. Because we are signs and wonders for these people on this earth. Just like Isaiah was. You, your kids, your family, whoever your little world consists of, you are signs and wonders for this world. So let's live it for Jesus.